Welcome to a Short in the Arm podcast. I am Yvette Raphael, your host. And this week, we are delighted to commemorate International Women's Day with our guest, Yumna Hatta, Senior Advisor, Gender and SRHR Frontline AIDS, Bernd Ruiz Snyder, Senior Director of Preclusion Project USA, and Toyin Chukwudozie, Executive Director, Education as a Vaccine, EVA in Nigeria. The past few years has seen great progress and sadly, as well, just as much regression. The reinstatement of the Mexico City policy, more well known as the global gag rule, the ban on abortions in many states of the U.S., the decision by USA Congress to let reauthorization of funding for PEPFAR labs still pending a vote, and worse still, the growing and widely supported anti-rights and anti-LGBTQI plus movements, global health organizations, advocates, and those on the ground are straining not to fail behind on the goals of an HIV-free future. But there's clearly more than enough holding us back from achieving that. And my guests today will take us through their thoughts, and I would like to hand it over to Yumna. Yumna, are you seeing a decline in rights-based HIV care?
Yeah. Hi, Beth. yes, I definitely am. Just through the work that we are doing at Frontline AIDS and hearing what partners are saying, we have seen decline in specific countries where legislation has been really harmful to the LGBTI and key populations. And so services have been cut, services have been taken away, the lived experiences of people that are transgender have been ignored. It's just not been easy in the last 2 years and moving forward. And it's just a violation of human rights.
Yeah, very sad indeed. Toyin, what's your perspectives on this?
Yes, thank you, Yvette. Same as just like what Yumna has just said. We're seeing a lot of rollback in progress that has been made, especially when it comes to sexual and reproductive health and rights. And of course, this impacts access to prevention services. We're also seeing that there's a misunderstanding of, you know, what the global gag rule has said and, you know, how it affects different organizations. And so people are not sure exactly, you know, what to do and what not to do. Civil society funding has been reduced, you know, in the last few years, especially for those who work on comprehensive sexual, reproductive, and health and rights services. So yes, it's impacting, you know, work that is happening at national level, because you know that any decrease in funding or resources whatsoever has direct implications on the people who are at the last mile receiving the services. So it's really restraining in a way in terms of how far civil society organizations like us can reach with the programs that we have for advancing sexual reproductive health and rights, and also for ending AIDS.
Yes, and it's usually the funding, right? We are always struggling with the funding. But Bernd, based on the recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling, what has been your experience on the ground in the U.S.?
Well, it's a bleak time for sexual and reproductive health and rights in the United States. And I think in many ways, we're seeing in the U.S. the same patterns that people are seeing all over the world in terms of the anti-gender movement having a lot of success in local government, going after trans rights, where that is where they think they're going to be successful, going after abortion rights in the places where they think that will be successful, using all of it to shut down free speech and gathering and association and comprehensive education, like Toyin said. So I think this sort of the anti-gender movement's really good at using whatever weak spots they see, but they have the same basic playbook no matter where they are in the world.
Yeah, so let's start with the global north. And the call they do not seem to realize is coming from inside the house. We have all witnessed the decisions that they've taken on the world stage, but what has this impact of policies such as the global gag rule and the lapse of reauthorization of PEPFAR funding been for organizations specifically to those in Africa. And I'd like for you, Yumna or Toyin, to lead with this. Just give us a understanding of what is really happening.
So, you know, the gag rule was out once before. And now we've gone back to not having the gag rule. And now there is this tendency of maybe it will come back. But what did it do in the past and how did it impact our lives? It made us choose, you know, it made us choose from not having any services, because PEPFAR pays for a lot of services. PEPFAR is almost responsible for many livelihoods, you know, staff that work in these places. And we had to choose between PEPFAR money and money from that was not gagged coming from Europe, for example. And so we had to make these choices. And those monies that came were significantly less than what, you know, PEPFAR was giving. So we were sitting with not a question about, you know, how we're going to prevent HIV. We were choosing between prevention and survival. And that is not a good place to be in. And that is not a place we want to return to. Because literally we are cutting people off from their livelihoods and their survival when we are making these choices. And so what we are saying is, we don't want to go back there. And we're going to do everything to prevent that. But what is it that we need to do and how can we prevent that from happening? And I think that's the dilemma we are sitting with.
Your thoughts on this, Toyin, for us?
Yes, absolutely. What Yumna has said, we know that U.S. global health assistance is a lot. And for that funding to reduce by any amount, the impact is very much great. And so we need to, you know, think about the fact that these choices that have to be made, whether to take the money and be gagged or not, is about people's very lives. And it is really disappointing because, you know, with PEPFAR, PEPFAR is funding of, like you said, you know, HIV treatment and care, and has made so many like great milestones, has hit so many great milestones when it comes to treatment. And PEPFAR was actually instituted or started in a Republican government. It was the Bush administration, and it was so it's you know, hard to understand how now many years later another Republican government would come and would be debating, you know, what we know that was instituted in a conservative government, and they're not looking at all the impact, all the great achievement that PEPFAR has done so far. And they are focusing on something that is not even related to HIV treatment, care, and support. Abortion, safe abortion, and safe abortion advocacy or services has nothing to do with PEPFAR. So, but just like you had said, they take every opportunity, you know, to come in and close, you know, all the gaps and opportunities also for advancing public health outcomes. So it's not funny. It's disappointing is the word I said. It's disappointing where we have come to, where we're now negotiating, you know, saving lives when it comes to HIV and, you know, looking at comprehensive access to SRHR services and the fact that the U.S. government being the largest funder, for example, all the other, their funding affected even the United Nations institutions, for example. And so all the other organizations that civil society, local organizations that have to receive funding from all these other people are also impacted. We're also seeing that even the movement is weakened because people have to make this choice of, should we do this? Should we not do that? So the few people who would say, okay, we will stay to our values, you know, the numbers have reduced. And so the movement is not as strong as it used to be before the gag rule. These are some of the impacts that we are seeing on the ground. And it is hard to make progress on these issues if we're not, you know, working together, you know, in a stronger movement. So it's a lot of things in terms of the impact of the gag rule and even the recent Dobbs decision, for example, and how it is turning things around at our level. So we're seeing that while policy decisions are made at the US government level, it's impacting all of us in our countries, even when it has nothing to do with our own policies in country. And that's really scary.
Yeah, thanks so much, Toyin, for reminding us that our spaces, myself and Yumna, always talk about how these spaces is shrinking And we can really also attribute that to funding, people fearing that they will lose the funding if they speak up. So Bern, on from your side, how did American progressives allow this to happen? Because clearly how what happens in the global north and what how funders support us has an impact. But how do Americans allow this to happen?
It's a great question. And the US has been a really negative force on global abortion politics for the last 40 years, more than 40 years, almost 50 years now, since the Helms Amendment came into place. Essentially, as soon as abortion rights were federal in the United States, white old male politicians started adding abortion restrictions to US foreign policy. And we see that in legislation, but we see that with the gag rule, which is specific to the president and something that a Republican president brings in, first Ronald Reagan, then the first Bush, then Clinton removed it, then it came back with the second Bush, and then it was removed by Obama, and then it came back and expanded massively to all of global health assistance. So that captured PEPFAR for the first time with Trump. And so it's hard to fully encapsulate all the ways that US foreign policy is a negative on SRHR. And I just don't want to make it sound like the global gag rule is the only problem. What is happening right now is that we're faced with a moment in which we are trying to recover from 4 years of the US government being an active part of the anti-gender movement. So not just pushing out the global gag rule, disrupting all of those relationships and clinical services, but also promoting the Geneva Consensus Declaration, this sort of alternative treaty on eliminating bodily autonomy and abortion from global health law. Attempt. Let's be clear. It's not an actual treaty. And putting a lot of political power behind it. And so we're now living with what it meant to have the US swell the ranks and the funding to the anti-gender movement for 4 years. And I think what we're doing right now is trying to prepare for what happens if it comes back with even more money, even more focus, even more expansions. But the answer to sort of what are Americans doing is, we are up against the same profoundly anti-democratic forces as a lot of other countries. So we're up against voter suppression. We're up against gerrymandering. So sort of faking the size of congressional districts. And our Republican Party has become so much more radicalized in the last 5 years. So where you saw a George W. Bush really understand the power, the life-saving power of PEPFAR, there's still some members of his party who view it that way, but there's members now, Republican members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, who will not support PEPFAR because they will not do anything that benefits Africa. They'll say it out loud. Like, it's an extraordinary shift, and we've moved enormously just in the last 2 years towards a much more radical and Republican Party that's not interested in governing. So it's a huge problem in foreign policy, but it's a huge problem that you sort of see in the patterns of our own experience with our government as well.
Definitely a huge issue and something that we need to think about. And I always say this about people referring to the leaders and distancing countries from that. For me, it is worrying that the American people would agree that this is okay. The Republican Party has members, and these members are okay with the policies. But let's move on. Not only are we dealing with implementation, and now as well, the refusal to implement, but also the rise in the anti-rights movements across the globe. What's going on, Yumna? What are we seeing? I mean, this is just not on.
Well, it's a violation of human rights. That's what it is. It's anti-rights. It's a violation of human rights. But it's also this, and And Bern will be able to unpack it a little bit more. But it's also this, you know, particularly in the African countries that I've come across, is that we don't want to support you because human rights comes from the north. Yet we are happy to support the anti-rights movement, but it's also coming from the north. I mean, there's a strong pull from the US alone in particular, that's really pushing for anti-rights. So the US on the one hand says we want nothing to do with Africa unless they are able to follow through on what we are saying on happy families and what family should look like. So they are attacking family setups. They are attacking people. So the only best family that you can have is one with a mother and a father that's heterosexual, and you stay married no matter what violence you experience in that marriage, and you have your happy children. And that's the setup that they are pushing for. So if you're a single mom, if you're a single dad, if you're a widow, if you're a widower, if you decide to have children in a same-sex marriage, all of those things that moves outside of that unit, then you are considered, you know, not right in your mind, like what you corrupt kind of society. That's the kind of, and they're attaching it to religion, which we know is not the right way to go, but we have societies that believe and live by religion. And so if this is attached to religion, somehow it's legitimized and therefore encouraged. And so that's the kind of thing we are facing. So comprehensive sexuality is a no-no because we are teaching children how to have sex, which we all know is not true. And we all know that comprehensive sexuality education comes from an evidence-based, the lived experience of people. But yet we have to fight this. I mean, there's no proof, but they are saying it's not true. And so this fabrication of information, a lot of disinformation going around, and our communities are lapping it up, because they are attaching it to values. And somehow, if you don't, and you feel left out if you don't attach yourself to those values also. You know, it's very moralistic in the way that they're going about it. But there's also hard push, like countries like Uganda and the laws that they have, that is supporting it. And so we have neighbors turning on each other to spy and say that their neighbor is gay, or you know, we should be looking out. Maybe they're doing something that's not right. And it's almost like Rwanda, where, you know, people are spying on each other. So it's really creating a lot of violence and disturbance. That's what this anti-rights movement is doing.
Yeah, and I know Yumna, you and I from South Africa, it seems like the blueprint for what to do with regards to this. But I always say, we should not relax within South Africa. This can, what happens in Uganda and all the countries can also happen in South Africa, just like that, because it is based on morality. It's based on family, and it makes it look like a danger. What's the situation in Nigeria, Toya?
I mean, you can imagine, they are also very strongly rooted in Nigeria, and we have seen them become, you know, emboldened. They now have like more courage and, you know, more voice and visibility than they have had in the past. And I know we've moved away from, you know, talking about the gag rule and other global issues in the US, but those things that are happening there are also giving them more and more courage on the ground, because they are making reference to the, like, for example, the Dobbs decision. And they're using it for the arguments that they're having, you know, here in Nigeria. And their tactics are the same, based on falsehood, based on fear, just sharing misconceptions and myths around the issues, connecting issues that are not related. And when they talk about values, you know, they paint this picture of, you know, the most horrible picture that, you know, so somebody who is thinking about this, oh, this is really scary, especially when it comes to things like comprehensive sexuality education, where they are targeting parents, you know, and making, you know, how precious it is to have children. And, you know, people are saying, oh, they are teaching your children. So they are using, you know, the fear tactics, the lies and falsehood, and pushing these narratives out in the media and gaining more and more ground. As a matter of fact, I think it was in 2022, in Lagos State, there was a guideline released for safe termination of pregnancy for legal indications. in about a week or thereabouts, they had written in the press and said a lot of things and garnered enough sentiment for the government in that state to step it down, and within China eventually. And now people are asking that to be reinstated. And you see that every time there's something that looks like there's progress, they organize themselves again and, you know, put out information that gets the public to rally around them. So they are using the public a lot, and the misinformation that exists in the public domain, or rather the gap in information that exists in the public domain, to fuel their agenda. And it is connected to what is happening all over Africa. So the ones in Nigeria are connected to Uganda, they're connected to Kenya, they're connected to Ghana. So it is one group of people connected to, of course, where their funding and support is coming from the north. But you see, that part of the conversation is not out there. So people don't know so much that this is an agenda that is deeply rooted in, you know, the global anti-rights movement. So when it is localized, it seems like, oh, they are talking only about Nigerian issues or Kenyan issues or Uganda issues. But there's not much information about how this is a bigger network of people working against human rights. And, you know, we also lead very busy lives. So it's difficult for people to stop and reflect on some of these things, because when there's sensational headlines, you just jump on the news, read it, and you take it and, you know, even pass it on. So it's very few people that stop to reflect on what are these people saying? You know, can I even find any other information out there that balances this? And so that is also, you know, an advantage for them. And for us who are activists in this space and feminists and, you know, SRHR advocates, we are always reacting. You know, they organize and we react. So it's the same thing in Nigeria, really. And its impact is becoming, you know, more and more vicious than it had been in the past.
Yeah, thank you so much, Twain. And you bring up something that is so important, is that at some point, it feels like we do not have the institutional memory. And Bern, I'm going to challenge you a little bit here to just take us through really what is going on. And if you do have any memory around the Holy See and how well-oiled, financed, and organized this machinery is, and is still alive, nobody has to pick it up. I know we all forgot about it, but my entries into feminism activism was around the Holy See and how well it's organized. But they stay the same, and advocates, because we get so tired, we continuously change. Today it's Yvette, tomorrow it's Yumna. It's never just us taking us through the memories, the institutional memories and richness of our advocacy. So maybe you can enlighten us. How do we make this really do this differently so that we're not off caught off guard, like Toyen is saying?
Well, I want to give us some credit. I mean, we're up against something really big. And it's not just our sort of the lack of continuity or anything. They're getting paid a lot to be able to have the continuity that is harder for us. You know, they've been organizing since before ICPD, and they meet a lot, and they meet across religious differences. They meet with the exact sort of image of what Yumna talked about in terms of that traditional family structure and all the things that means. It means no CSE, it means no abortion rights, it means no emergency contraception. For a lot of folks, it means no contraception. It means no LGBTQ rights. It means child marriage. It means a whole host of things, but they don't bicker about any of those things. They stay really high level at relationship level, and they've been doing this and building it and building a quite literal playbook for 40 years. So there's a reason that there feels like sort of powerful continuity to them. It's not just the Holy See. That's really what we see at the UN level, but is the Holy See as this political power. But where we really, you know, the money, as Toyin said, it's Global North, but it's not, it's the anti-rights movement is heavily funded by American white evangelicals. And it's very hard for us to tell how much because churches in the United States don't have to report their spending. So where our, you know, our organizations have to keep detailed accounting and make it public, the churches don't. So it's we can't even tell you how much of their money is going to Uganda or Ugandan politicians or Ghanaian politicians. Heavily funded by U.S. evangelical churches, but also Citizen Go is a huge European power that's interfering with using social media and any number of other sort of the sort of creation of looking like it's an organic citizen-led organization, but it's definitely not, and uses very inorganic mechanisms to produce the look that they go for. And we're also seeing a lot of the money is coming from Russian oligarchs. And that's also very hard to track. But we know the World Congress of Families, a lot of these spaces are heavily funded from very conservative, anti-democratic forces in Russia. None of those are sort of organic Ghanaian or Kenyan or Nigerian movements, but they tap into reactionary conservative vibes in every country. But it's such a mistake to think it's organic because they really they find a little entry point, and an entry point that people are oftentimes not prepared as larger movements to defend. So, you know, where the feminist movement in the UK was unwilling to defend the corner of where trans women were, they made huge inroads there. So in the UK, abortion rights haven't become a big national conversation, but the rights of trans people sure have. It's the same movement where in another country, the best entry point is going to be around cracking down on abortion rights. They're not picky, but they are all working together and they do all have the same end goal.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you so much for, you know, giving credit to our own movements, women speaking, fighting against all odds. Like you say, some of these machineries are big. Some of them are literally invisible. I know in South Africa, they're invisible. We're just not seeing them because they're waiting for the perfect time to strike when we are feeling vulnerable. It comes up during election times. We have, you know, stuff going on during election times, and you can just see how society is ready to bite on it. It's possible that, you know, the U.S. will have a new president at the end of this year. With that comes a real risk of, you know, again, the global gag rule being reintroduced. But for me, I would like to say, I don't think it's even just the new president. I want to focus it on elections in the U.S. Every time there is an election in the U.S., what happens to me, my heart goes to the top because I'm holding my breath and hoping that whoever is in charge does not do injustice to this work that we are doing. It's really not about the president. It's really about how this person feels. The presidential election, is that the truth or is it a party thing? I think it's just go to sleep, wake up, go to sleep kind of thing. Because it doesn't go away. And I want to ask you, Ben, to lead us on this. We are going to go straight to the problem. Ben, lead us on this.
No,
it's just understand what is happening. Like I say, it feels like, and then the Democrats win. It's like almost change, Leki Tamalaki.
At the federal level in the United States, yes, we're in a different moment with a Democratic president, but we never even get back to zero. Abortion is overwhelmingly popular in the United States, but that's not reflected in any of our political parties. The Democrats are worlds better, but But when you see the type of energy, activism, messaging in the movement in the United States, it's still really disconnected from the sort of like tepid, safe and legal kind of language that we get from our politicians for the most part. There's a few exceptions, but certainly this White House, you know, has barely gotten us back to sort of an okay place on sexual and reproductive rights. You should be scared for the U.S. election. The U.S. global health assistance is a significant force in the world. And when people come into power who want to use it as a force for reactionary anti-gender activity, it's powerfully poisonous. The Trump administration viewed the world as good people and abortionists, and they wanted to sever and create as much dichotomy there as possible. So the disruptions in relationships, people being scared to work with other people, dropping out of coalitions, that's all intended. They're happy to do that. They're happy. The fact that we all say, well, if they just understood that the global gag rule actually increased abortion because people lose access to family planning, or that it actually increases maternal mortality, or if they just No, they don't care. They have an absolutely black and white worldview. And how that plays out in people's lives doesn't actually matter to them at all.
Yeah.
What we expect if a Republican comes back into power is much worse than what we've seen before. They've put it all in writing, and they've put it in writing in a document called the Mandate for Leadership under the heading of Project 2025, which is a plan for what happens when a conservative president comes back. They intend it to be, you know, next year at this time. And that plan includes extending the global gag rule to all of U.S. assistance. So that includes humanitarian assistance and human rights funding and all development assistance. They intend to extend it directly to U.S.-based organizations who have had to pass it down to their foreign partners, but because of free speech in the United States and constitutional concerns, hasn't been applied directly to them. It seems like the conservatives are ready to scrap that. They want to extend it to all multilaterals, so the UN agencies and others, and they want to extend it to government funds. Not all of those things are legal, but they're going to throw it all at the wall and then force us, like four lawyers, six activists, and a box of pens to fight it. Like, and we're so overworked already, but we're going to have to figure out our legal strategy and our advocacy strategy on all of these things. Because they don't care if it's legal. That's the least of their concerns. So they're planning these four expansions. And I think, I'm sorry to sort of be such a bummer and to take up the space, but I think it's important to know that those expansions come within this really powerfully anti-democratic framework. They intend to get rid of most of the career foreign service, the sort of career bureaucrats in the United States, the ones that are not attached to a political party and who just do the work, right? The contracts, the everything else. They want to get rid of them and put political partisans in their place. So the type of folks who we saw two or three of them at USAID during the Trump administration, they would now be in power with hundreds of sort of true believers in the agencies, sort of across the board. They don't want us to come back from this plan. They don't intend for the United States to continue to be a democracy. At CPAC, which is a big conservative political meeting in Washington that took place last week, one of the speakers said straight up, this is the plan for the end of democracy. So we at our peril believe that this moment is similar to the moments we've seen before around the return of the gag rule. This is something much worse that is embedded in an authoritarian movement in the United States. And we have to name it and call it what it is in order to really get people who don't necessarily see themselves as part of the feminist movement or the HIV movement or the LGBT movement to get everybody facing and fighting the same threat.
Oh, thank you so much, Bern. But I would like to hear from Toyin and Yumna. How do we start organizing for a critical time like this as the region, as Africa? And for those who are not involved already, how do they get involved in this work that we are doing? Clearly, real, real hard work. And almost, it looks almost impossible for us to win.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to think about. It's hard to imagine. But yet it's not that difficult to imagine because we've almost been there and we tried to turn around at it. And now it looks like we're getting back there. One of the things that I keep on nagging about is the Maputo Plan of Action, the Maputo Protocol. It's actually something, it's one of the most leading documents globally that the AU put together to protect women. And abortion is allowed in there. Abortion is part of it, protecting safe abortions. It's women's rights. It's a feminist document. Maybe here and there we could tweak a bit. I think there's little said about LGBTI communities. But you know what? Our African states have signed on to this. So if they sign on to this, because it was all in the name of making Africa a great place, you know, why are they listening to a global gag rule? Why are they responding to a northern kind of imposition that is not even legislation or law, when they've signed onto a commitment on the African continent that is so progressive and feminist in its understanding? We should be holding them accountable for that. Really, we should be holding them accountable to what they've signed on to. Because they sign on to this, they promised us, the people of Africa, that they're going to protect us, but then they allow the global gag rule to come in and take away that. That's really a dichotomy, but it's wrong. It's just wrong. The other thing is we have the foreign feminist policies that are coming out. You see a lot of countries in the north are now developing these foreign feminist policies, and there's even an index that goes with it. And I think it's not just to take that and try and inspire us here in the south. Because I think the South is organizing themselves. We know what we want. We know where we're going. I mean, the existence of the MPOA, the Maputo Plan of Protocol, is definitely an indication of that. But what we should be doing is we should be pushing those very northern countries that have developed these feminist foreign policies within their countries and in their governments to hold the US and similar countries accountable. And use that and inspire that kind of work instead of trying to inspire us. They need to inspire those countries and say, hello, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're being exclusive. You are dividing and conquering. What are you trying to end the world? You claim Africa is a shithole, but you're creating your own shithole. You know, it's that kind of accountability that we need to start seeing that needs to become more prevalent. In the same way that we need to hold our African and Southern leaders accountable for the kind of documents they sign in the name of putting them in position. Yeah.
Yeah, totally, Yumna. And I want to acknowledge the fact that we are mad, we are angry, we are tired. But Toyin, your thoughts on this?
I think it's not a matter of how to start organizing, because organizing is happening already in different ways with different groups. Maputo is one thing that belongs to us. It's our own. There's also opportunity for CPD. CPD is 30 this year. And, you know, we need to have more voices speaking in support of advancing what is in those commitments that they made as far back as 1994 in Cairo. CPD was also negotiated on the African continent. And so it's really... For me, as somebody who, I mean, at 94, I knew my name, but I barely knew myself. And coming so many years later, you know, when we should really be advancing and seeing us, you know, taking three decades steps backwards. So this is another opportunity for all of our movements to come together and speak to each other and talk with each other. We need each other at this point to connect the work that we are doing. The people who are working in the Global North, people working in Global South, we need to speak to each other and advance, you know, our strategies. I see an opportunity also in engaging young people. We need a critical mass that speaks up. And we know that young people have the energy, the time, the platform, everything to say what they want to say, you know, and get and have their voices heard, you know, with all the technology platforms that are available to us. We need that critical mass of young people speaking for the right to bodily autonomy. We need for that to be something that is, you know, heard across the different countries in Africa and connecting to other parts of the world where young people are. They understand that this is an attack on their rights to bodily autonomy and they stand against it. So that's an opportunity for, you know, having that critical mass and that voice. I mean, I know they have a lot of money and power on the side of the opposition, but they can't, they cannot also, with all the money and power that they have, they are really, you know, taking advantage of the lack of information and lack of engagement that the larger public is having in this situation. So we need to zone in on that ourselves. And lastly, I want to say that our own governments need to step up, because if money and resources from the North is what is being wielded to move us from one end of, you know, of progress to another, our national governments also have to step up and put their money also where their mouth is. They need to bring, also put the resources for advancing programs in for SRHR, for HIV. So whatever is happening, whether it's with PEPFAR or whether it's with other forms of global health assistance, shouldn't have this huge, you know, negative impact on our lives, on our health. So our governments also need to step up and do their part to fulfill, you know, government responsibilities for health and human rights in Africa.
Thank you so much. But I just want to hear from you. How has the global gag rule actually affected new HIV infections or HIV infections or care for HIV?
It's doubled the amount of infections from what we could have prevented. In other words, what the global gag rule did was it took away the gains we made. And you know, in South Africa, the movement, the HIV movement really developed here, because this is where the burden of the disease was. And we could see the impact here, because PEPFAR, I mean, I, having worked at PEPFAR, I know how much money went into South Africa. I mean, and it was, I mean, at the point when I was working, there was 4.8 billion for that 1 year alone that PEPFAR invested in South Africa. Now think about turning that around, and you know, now making choices about giving up my million I get from PEPFAR and my 100,000 I get from CEDA. I've got to choose between the two. And what is that million servicing and what is that 100,000 doing? 100,000 is for advocacy and the million is for actual services, for treatment, for care, for prevention. So I'm going to allow people to think and imagine, if you remove the million, what are you doing? You're literally killing people. You're terminating lives. And when the gag rule happened, that's what happened. And if it's coming back the way Byrne says it's going to come back, you might as well double, you know, exponentially bring up the million to a lot more. Because it's not just the lives we lost to HIV, but it's the lives we lost to abortion. It's the lives we lost to maternal child health. It's just exponentially a lot more. And I don't want to go into that. But that's exactly what happened. I mean, in a nutshell, that is what happened when the gag rule came. And besides that, there was lots of bickering between organizations, because if you were in the movement, you were there for human rights because you take a rights-based approach to your programming. And then you start saying, but oh no, they accepted the gag rule. They accepted the money. And but we didn't. We stood up against the gag rule. And so there was a lot of bickering amongst organizations themselves. They started thinking, who do we associate with? Who do we put our names with? It was a lot of dividing and conquering. And that's exactly what the anti-rights movement feeds on the kind of division that exists within our movements. And that's what happened. That's what happened. We lived through that. And we cannot go there. It was dark and it was deadly. It was fatal. And we don't want to turn there.
Very dangerous discussions that happen amongst men, I would say. And I know I stand to be corrected, but the leadership is so, so patriarchal. And these decisions are very patriarchal. We cannot hide from that. But as we almost at the end of the show, I'd like to just give you ladies, because this is a powerhouse, like four women, when people are going to look at us, they're going to see four powerful women. What are your parting shots? This, International Women's Day, women globally are doing amazing work. From my side, women are doing amazing work. But what are your parting shots? What would you like women to know in a world where such dangerous decisions are being made on our behalf? So I'll start with you, Bern.
It's an intense brief, but I think this is a very serious moment, and it's a very serious moment in the United States, and certainly recognizing then how that impacts the rest of the world. I want to make sure the HIV movement, which is still a lot of dudes, right? We are four powerful women in the HIV movement, but there's so many men and so many people who think, well, we can just do ARV services, but we don't have to touch the sticky bits. We don't have to talk about sex. We don't have to talk about drug use. We don't have to talk about violence. We'll just do ARVs. The whole HIV movement needs to remember that all the gains we've made in the last 40 years have been centering most impacted populations, have been led by women and girls, have been led by LGBTQ people, have especially been led by trans women. And we have to remember that it was all of those gains made by taking a human rights-based approach, by meeting people where they are in their lives and giving them the information, the supports, and the power they need. And a lot of that comes through integrated services. It comes through people having the type of clinical experience they want to have. They're trying to take all of that away from us. And they're trying to do that by going after the edges that the movement broadly is least willing to defend. So those men in the HIV movement have to understand that when they're coming for abortion, they're coming for the HIV movement. When they're coming for trans people, they are coming for the HIV movement. And we have to hold firm at those edges where they think we are weakest and least willing to take a really firm stand. And so, yes, it's International Women's Day, but it's also a call to all of the men in our movements saying, understand that this is about you. They may start with us, but they will not stop with us. They are not going to stop with an abortion restriction. They never have and they never will. So stand with us now so it does not get worse. And that's my rallying cry, I think, on this International Women's Day.
Thank you so much, Bern. And I think that message will spread globally. Toyin, from your side, what's your parting shots? What do you want to say to women? This is International Women's Month Day.
You're right. I mean, women's bodies have become the highest political debates on the globe right now. And I think what I want to say is that we need to band together and tell them that our bodies cannot be what they are debating, you know, to make decisions about people's lives. Decisions about our bodies are supposed to be ours to make, and it shouldn't be a source of, you know, resource allocation and resource, whatever politicking that they're doing. Especially with the people who have the most power in the North. And so, just like what Ben said, we all need to come together because, like, they're not going to stop at women. We've heard recent, you know, rulings from courts attacking as much as IVF, and it's from there to wherever else. And so it's unimaginable how far they can go. And it is time for all of us to say, you know, they should, their hands off our bodies. Take your hands and your mouths off our bodies and focus on, you know, other things in the world, world peace, focus on other things that are for development. And your mouth and your hands off our bodies. Your policy should not be one that restricts bodily autonomy. Everybody, man, woman, gender diverse people, we all have a right to make decisions about our bodies, including the ones who are, say, doing what they're doing in opposition to bodily autonomy. Every single person has a right to bodily autonomy. And on this International Women's Day, we're saying that women's bodies must be free.
Thank you so much, Toy. And over to you, Yumna, your final part in short.
Yeah, for me, on this International Women's Day, my heart goes out to all the women out there in the diversity. But more importantly, that the message I want to put out is that your lived experience counts. Your lived experience is what needs to inform policy. And if it's not, get up, stand up, negotiate, network, and collaborate and rise up and hold your leaders accountable. Because you count and your lived experience matters.
Thank you so much, Yumna, and everyone for joining us. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Frontline Aids, Eric Esperal, producer, Waisha Rafael, the production coordinator, and my co-host, Ben. And for all of our followers and listeners, my final thought is we are all beneficiaries of our own advocacy. Thank you.